From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Ebonics, a bridge to learning or the ghettoization of education. Also, Straight News, a history of the media's coverage of gays and lesbians.
Most of the information, a huge percentage of the information, came either from psychiatrists or police. And they had their own ideology that they were trying to put across at that time. And even though the news media may have thought that they were putting across objective, balanced information, they were relying on sources that were neither objective nor balanced. Therefore, the image that was created was a distorted one.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge yesterday granted a preliminary injunction blocking Proposition 209, the voter-approved initiative that would roll back affirmative action programs in California. The injunction, handed down by U.S. District Judge Thelton Henderson of San Francisco, bars California Governor Pete Wilson and Attorney General Dan Lundgren from implementing Proposition 209 until the judge resolves the dispute over its constitutionality. In his decision granting the injunction, Henderson said that the voter-approved measure probably violated the constitutional right to equal protection. The Republicans' desire for a swift and neat resolution of House Speaker Newt Gingrich's confessed ethical breach before the new Congress convenes January 7th and votes on a new speaker has begun to run into serious obstacles that could foil their strategy. GOP leaders are confident quick action will produce mild sanctions and the re-election of Gingrich as Speaker. But some House Democrats have vowed to slow the pace of the committee's deliberations and force Republicans, if they choose, to re-elect Gingrich as Speaker before his ethics case has been fully resolved. The House Democratic leadership said yesterday the Republican strategy has been to stall the investigation for 2 years, and now they want it resolved in 2 weeks. They want to sweep it under the rug. We are not going to agree to that. No progress is apparent after Sunday's big release of hostages in Peru, a day after releasing 225 of their captives in what they called a Christmas gesture. The approximately 20 Tupac Amaru guerrillas continue to hold 140 at the Japanese ambassador's residence in Lima. Peruvian President Fujimori announced a holiday amnesty for 132 prisoners, but none of them were members of the rebel group. The standoff could soon start pinching the economy if it drags on, this according to some analysts. Two women linked to a Thai firm gave $185,000 to the Democratic Party within days of a White House coffee when attended with the president. The money was later returned because the source of the funds was uncertain. The meeting indicates Clinton was more involved in party fundraising than had been known. And Asian American activists bristled yesterday at President Clinton for saying that the culture out of which they come could have led fundraisers John Huang and Charles Yalin Tree unwittingly to do wrong. The advocates said Huang and Tree's ethnicity was no excuse for the fundraisers or the politicians who use them. Clinton said in a Los Angeles Times interview published yesterday, "The reason I have not been more critical of Charlie Tree or John Huang is that it is not clear to me to what extent they knew exactly what they were doing and whether it was wrong." He then added, "One thing we know is that the culture out of which they come doesn't draw the same bright lines between politics, government, and business that we do." Margaret Fung of the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund in New York said cultural differences should not be a defense for what they're doing or what they may have done. 8 workers in Houston died when they removed the lid from a tank that hadn't been depressurized. The accident occurred at a military contractor owned by Wyman Gorman Corporation. The company had been cited by OSHA for problems at other facilities, but the Houston plant hadn't had any fatalities since it opened in the 1960s. And this international news. At least one person was killed in an attack at the cathedral in East Timor's capital of Dili today, as thousands waited for afternoon mass to be said by Nobel Peace Laureate Bishop Carlos Jimenez Bello. Tens of thousands of people greeted Bello when he returned to East Timor from a European trip that included a meeting with Pope John Paul II. Some residents estimated the crowd at more than 30,000 when Bello arrived home on a regular flight. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Ebonics. It's a word that's new to most of us, and it's generating a big controversy between educators, parents, and civil rights leaders. Ebonics is the name given to African-American vernacular, otherwise known as Black English. Last week, the Oakland, California School Board unanimously passed a resolution recognizing Ebonics as a second language. The board authorized the creation of a training program to help teachers better understand what their African-American students are saying. The decision to accept Ebonics has been criticized from all sides of the political spectrum. Jesse Jackson called the decision the laughing stock of the nation. He said the move was an unacceptable surrender, borderlining on disgrace, and that if the schools were going to recognize a second language, it should be Spanish or French. We're joined by two people to give us background on this issue. Professor John Rickford is with us. He's a linguistics professor at Stanford University who teaches a course on African-American vernacular. He's co-authoring a book on Ebonics. And we're joined by Carolee Tolbert. She's a member of the Oakland School Board that made this decision last week. Carolee Tolbert, why don't we begin with you? Can you explain how the whole issue came into being in Oakland?
California, graduate of Oakland Public Schools. Mm-hmm. With kids, you know, I had kids in Oakland Public Schools as well.
Yes. Can you tell
me what the situation is? I'm also a practitioner. You know, I work with Oakland Public School students year-round. Mm-hmm. So our policies not only impact the policies I help to make,
Carolee,
you know, also impact my children
your own kids.
And the children
yeah.
I work with.
Carolee Tolbert?
Yes.
Ooh. Can you hear
yes,
me?
Yes, I can hear you
yes,
very
you
well.
Could you start off by explaining to us how this all took place, how the decision was made, and who actually brought the issue of Ebonics to the school board?
Okay. Is this Amy?
Yes.
Okay.
We're on the air.
Oh, okay. We didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me just say briefly that several months ago, my colleague on the school board, Tony Cook, called for the formation of the African-American Task Force on the status of African-American students in the Oakland Public Schools. And their findings, of course, were not surprising, that, for instance, 71% of our youngsters are in special, 71% of the special ed students are African-American students, 80%, and this is very alarming, 80% of our students who are suspended are African-American students. The majority of students who are retained are African-American students, and it goes on and on. And the GPA of our African-American male youngsters are the lowest in the district. So what the task force recommended to the Board of Education was, I think, five or six areas of action that we needed to concentrate on, one of which was to recognize that many African-American students in Oakland come from home environments where standard English proficiency is not spoken. Mothers and fathers of whom most of whom do not have a high school diploma or a college degree. And so oftentimes those youngsters come to the school deficient in standard English proficiency skills. And so the intent of this policy is to ensure that those youngsters coming to school are not seen by teachers as deficient in any way. It's to develop a much more holistic response to the needs of African-American students, as we do for all of our other youngsters, and to help staff develop the skills and the tools to work more effectively with African-American students by instructing them in standard English and recognizing that the linguistic patterns that they use are not standard English, and that it is not okay for youngsters not to know the difference, and to focus on helping those youngsters transition to standard English proficiency skills.
But talking about Ebonics as a second language, how does that change how teachers will teach?
Okay, I have to say to you that all of us are not necessarily 100% agreement with particular terminologies. What we are saying, and what I am certainly saying, is that for the past 20 years, and I have to speak to you from a perspective as a trustee, for the past 20 years, Oakland Public Schools, like many urban school districts, have categorized a lot of African-American students as special ed, as ADD, as EDD, all these dysfunctional terms, and based on pathologies. And so what we're saying is, instead of seeing African-American students who are limited in English standard English skills as pathological or deficient, we're saying seeing them as different, but understanding the role of a teacher is to teach all students standard English skills. So it is looking at, it's trying to address the attitudes of our teachers. It's trying to address how teachers see not only our students, but how they embrace our parents. Most of the parents who have students with limited English proficiency skills who are African-American parents typically are not empowered parents. They typically do not know how to access the system. They typically do not know how to advocate effectively on behalf of their children. And so as a trustee, my role is to recognize what are the barriers facing all of our youngsters. Some of our youngsters have disabilities, and we have to, physical disabilities, and we have to accommodate those youngsters. We have to say, irrespective of a child's perceived ability, their race, gender, or even socioeconomic status, that they have a right to a quality education in the Oakland Public Schools, and we have to recognize that Chapter 1 funds and all these other programs that were infused in the 60s and 70s have not worked. And we have to recognize our responsibility in changing that paradigm.
But how will the teaching change? I still don't quite understand that.
The teaching, okay, one of I think one of the benefits that I bring to the Board of Education is the fact that I'm also a practitioner. Not only do I develop policy for the Oakland Public Schools, but I also work in our community, designing educational programs and parent programs to work with our parents. And one of the trends that I have seen over the last 20 years, I've done this for about 30 years, disturbing to me is that oftentimes when I'm looking at completed work of African-American students, they are not, the writing skills of our youngsters are terribly deficient. And oftentimes what teachers will do, rather than correct a youngster and say, okay, I recognize that this is your social language or this is your home language, but when we are transitioning to developing work skills and how to communicate cross-culturally, there is a standard for that. And that standard is standard English proficiency. And so rather than teachers ignoring the fact that kids come with those deficiencies and saying it's okay, but helping youngsters bridge the gap, helping them as I was helped, as many of us were helped when we were going to school, to understand the difference between our home language and the language of economy.
Is it giving more credibility to the home language? It's saying, instead of saying, you're wrong here and this is how you have to say it, saying, this is your language and this is another language that you have to learn? Is that what it is?
No. What we're saying is kids from African-American backgrounds, as youngsters from Asian or Hispanic backgrounds, come with linguistic patterns that are inconsistent with standard English, period.
Well, presumably teachers have been correcting them for a long time.
But they have not, and this is what I'm sharing with you. They have not been correcting them. In fact, you probably are aware that oftentimes teachers use rapping and all these other modes to get kids interested in education. And in fact, that doesn't work. What it does, that in fact plays down to the youngster. That doesn't raise their skills. And what we are saying is, irrespective of the linguistic patterns that these children bring, the role of a teacher in the Oakland Public School is to teach standard English proficiency. Not only that, and this is very critical, most of our urban children are viewed by many of the professionals as dysfunctional in some way because they have these differences. And I don't mean that this is intentional. I just mean that this has been the pattern for the last 20 years because that has been the way the money has gone. Schools, in fact, receive money from Chapter 1 depending upon how badly or how poorly children test on standardized tests. So there is a disincentive. There has been a disincentive to really teach children. And what we're saying, not unlike the reauthorization of Chapter 1, that unless kids begin to move academically, they're going to take that money away. And what we're saying, we can no longer depend on those kinds of resources in order to teach our children. And so what we want our teachers to do is see all children as whole, as healthy, as valued human beings, not to relegate them to special ed status or to classify them in any demeaning way because they are different.
Let's bring Professor Rickford into this conversation, linguistics professor at Stanford University. You're writing a book on Ebonics. Can you explain how it got coined? What was the movement behind this?
Well, the term Ebonics itself is not really that important. The term was coined by a number of African-American linguists in the 1970s, around 1973, and it was first used in a book in 1975. One of the reasons why African-American linguists suggested...
Which came from ebony phonics,
from
Ebonics?
Ebony, yes. The word ebony combined with phonics, meaning sounds. One of the reasons why people developed this term, because at that time it was being called non-standard Negro English. That just goes to show you how long ago people were talking. And people wanted to avoid the negative connotations of that term. So Ebonics is a term they propose, and it has commanded a good deal of respect. It never really became current. In fact, this current discussion is the most popular and widespread the term has ever become.
Uh-huh.
So in a sense, the controversy has given new life to the term. But what's important is the systematicity, the structure. And what's important, there's several things that I consider just marvelous about the Oakland decision. And I think it's important for these points to be made because people have been quite, I don't want to say ignorant, but non-understanding both of the nature of the problem and the nature of the solution. Let me say, first of all, the first good thing about the Oakland School Board's decision is that it casts a light on the devastating situation which has been affecting African-American kids, particularly from the working class inner-city areas, really for the last at least 20 years, 30 years, in which kids have been falling behind steadily the longer they stay in school. It's a terrible problem, and it particularly affects reading and writing as skills and reading and writing in standard English. Let me give you some data on this. For instance, if you take the spotlight off of Oakland, because people have begun to suggest this is an Oakland problem and it's because Oakland is not succeeding that they're getting desperate, let's look at some other studies. For instance, in Philadelphia, for instance, let's go back east. Data from 1976, 20 years ago, indicated that at the elementary school level, 31% of the kids was scoring below the 16th percentile on reading. That's at the elementary level. By the junior high level in the black school, Cook School, 50% of the kids were scoring below the 16th percentile. And then by the high school level, for instance, at Franklin School, 75% of the kids were scoring below the 16th percentile and 95% below the mean, below 50%. If you look at the East Palo Alto data, Ravenswood School District from 1989 to 1990. Kids come to school at the third grade level. They're reading at the 16th percentile. By the time they get to the sixth grade level, they're reading at the third percentile. And by the time they get to the eighth grade level, they're reading at the second percentile, which is about as low as you can possibly get. By contrast, in Palo Alto, which is a white area, kids come to school reading at the 96th percentile at the third grade level. And by the sixth grade level, they're at the 99th percentile, which is as high as you can get. Therefore, schools have been serving white kids for years, for decades, in positive ways that build on their linguistic skills. But within the African-American community, whether you look at Oakland, East Palo Alto, Philadelphia, New York, kids have been doing steadily worse.
Professor Rickford, we have to break for a minute, but then when we come back, I want to find out how it is, what studies show that classifying this language as Ebonics and changing a teaching style would help improve the reading level and comprehension level.
I would love to talk about that.
We're talking with Professor John Rickford, a Stanford University linguistics professor, and Carol Lee Tolbert, a trustee on the Oakland Board of Education. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Hey, Daddy, what that there? And why that under there? And oh, Daddy, oh, hey, Daddy, hey, look it over there. Hey, what they doing there? And where they going there? And Daddy, can I have that big elephant over there? Hey, who that in my chair? And what she doing there? And oh, Daddy, oh, hey, Daddy, can I go over there? Hey, Daddy, what's a square? And where do we get air? And Daddy, can I have that big elephant over there? My quizzical kid, man, he doesn't want anything here. He's forever demanding to know who, what, and why, and where. Inquisitive child, and sometimes the questions get wild. Like, Daddy, can I have that big elephant over there? Don't want to comb my hair.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about Ebonics. Our guests, Carol Lee Tolbert, a trustee with the Oakland Board of Education, and Professor John Rickford, linguistics professor at Stanford University, is writing a book on Ebonics. So how does classifying it as Ebonics change the style of teaching?
Can I take that question?
Sure.
Okay.
I'll be happy to come back in.
For us, what it does, it takes it out of the realm of pathology, and it gives teachers a different attitude and perspective when they are working with African-American youngsters. In 1987, I conducted a survey in Oakland with principals as to what are the major factors in student success. And without exception, there were three general themes. One was parent involvement. The second was student motivation and self-esteem. And the third, believe it or not, was high expectations of teachers, of the student. And what we have, I think, experienced in the last or over the last 15 or 20 years, there has been very low expectations of inner-city youngsters.
And how would this teaching change it? Just because we only have a few minutes to understand, it seems to be.
Approach. It would change their attitudinal approach to how they instruct children. Teachers grade children, and I tell teachers this all the time, they are the most significant individual to a youngster other than their parent. And so it is very important that positive messages are sent from teachers and that they are received from children, that they are okay, that they can succeed. And teachers have to begin to recognize their own biases. And part of my job is to help staff develop the skills, the tools, as well as the attitude to assist youngsters through this developmental process.
So is it fair to say it's respecting the way they speak and saying this is another way to speak that you have to use in the outside world sort of to get ahead?
Right.
It's saying that children have to develop skills, survival skills, and part of that is learning the language of economy. Yes.
Professor Rickford, you wanted to get
in? Yeah, I did. But first of all, I want to agree fully with Carol Lee Tolbert. The connection between attitudes and expectations and performance is absolutely well established. And the judge, Justice Joyner, in the 1979 Ann Arbor case, in which parents brought suit against the school district of Ann Arbor for not taking the language of their kids into account, drew on all the linguistics research to show that it was the negative attitudes that people had toward the language that affected their expectations and their performance. But beyond just attitudes, because I don't want you to just think that this is a question about just feeling warm and fuzzy and everything turns right. I do want to let you know that there's very systematic linguistic evidence that shows that methods that do contrastive analyses of the difference between non-standard dialects and standard dialects, and then uses that to pinpoint the areas in which kids need to improve, on which kids need to work, have been shown to work far, far better. For instance, Hanny Taylor did a book in 1989, republished in 1991, describing an 11-week project in Chicago at Aurora University in Chicago, He had an experimental group where he used this contrastive analysis that looked at the structural differences between African-American or English or Ebonics and Standard English. And he had a control group where they just taught people using the usual traditional English department techniques. And what he found was that in the experimental group, they showed after an 11-week period 59% reduction of the use of AV features in their writing, while the control group that followed the traditional English department techniques showed a slight increase, 8.5%, in the use of AV features in standard English writing. There's other studies, Simpkins and Simpkins 1981, where they looked at, in fact, 540 students in 27 different classes across the country. And they tried experimental methods in which they would begin with dialect readers and then transition through intermediate readers and then into standard English readers and teaching kids. Again, fully respecting and taking advantage of the kids' home language. What they found is that for 4 months of instruction, kids who were using the experimental methods, using the dialect, using Ebonics, gained 6.2 months of reading development, whereas the kids in the control group that used the traditional methods showed only 1.6 months of development. And this work goes way back to the 1960s. This was, in fact, some of the earliest work was done in Sweden, where Tore Osterberg in 1961 talked about using non-standard English, non-standard Swedish to teach standard Swedish, and he showed that the results were far stronger and more successful than with regular approaches that just use standard Swedish.
Professor Rickford, there's a piece, an editorial in the New York Times today, and I assume it's written by Brent Staples because I talked to him yesterday, and he was just outraged by all of this. And it's a piece truly condemning what the Oakland School Board decision was. It says that the resolution passed calls for recognition of African language systems, ordering officials to support black students in what the board calls their primary language. Uh-huh. The measure requires teachers to become certified in new training methods and offers incentives, including salary bonuses, for those who brush up on inner city slang.
First of all, you're not talking about slang. We're not just talking about vocabulary. We're talking about very, very systematic and deep-rooted differences in grammar. And secondly, Brent Staples and the rest of the country, the people who are talking about these issues, are simply uninformed. The existence and the regularity of African-American English is absolutely undeniable, and no amount of wishing the other way will make things change. For instance, there was work that was done in the 1960s and work since then that shows if you give kids the very simple task of repeating a sentence given them in one dialect, they will instantly translate it and repeat it in the other dialect and not follow the norms, the patterns that you gave them. For instance, Baratz and her colleagues did some work in Washington, D.C. They gave kids a sentence. I asked Tom if he wanted to go to the picture that was playing at the Howard. 97% of the kids in the third and fourth grade level said immediately, I asked Tom, did he want to go to the picture at the Howard? Works the other way. They asked white kids. They gave them the African-American English or Ebonic sentence. I asked Tom, do he want to go to the picture that be playing at the Howard? 78% of them immediately said, I asked Tom if he wanted to go to the picture that was playing at the Howard. Now, the point is that these differences are out there. You can object all you want. All you have to do is walk into any urban schoolyard, talk to African-American kids, or better yet, listen, and you will hear these patterns. So you can either bury your head in the sand and see kids slide down that slippery slope that the schools have been leading them down for the last 3 decades.
Do you think this will mean a number of kids will come out of special ed?
Absolutely.
The point is, if those who are in special ed are not getting the particular kinds of training they need. It's like having a car that has something wrong with its carburetor and taking it to a muffler shop to get fixed.
Right.
It's simply not going to improve. You have to understand the nature of the problem. Now, the good news is that the kids do have a systematic language. Thank God, because if they didn't, you couldn't fix it. Imagine if your car had a knock. It was totally random. You could never fix it. But suppose the knock only occurred every time you turn left, then you could say, maybe it has something to do with the steering wheel, right? So the point is that African-American kids have a very systematic variety. Studies have shown that if you take it into account, you actually improve the teaching of standard English. I'm not sure how Brent Staples, Jesse Jackson, or Maya Angelou, all of whom I respect and admire in so many ways, could simply be so blinded on this point not to realize the reality of what's going on out there and the fact that the Oakland School Board shares with them the absolute interest and conviction of seeing these kids speak and read in standard English and are finally beginning to do something about it.
Carolee Tolbert, we only have about 30 seconds, but I want to ask you this. Will this further segregate kids? Because if you have teachers that are trained in inner city slang, as they're calling it, or that are trained in Ebonics so that they can help the students more, then you're going to have kids separated out in classrooms that to learn English separate from other students.
What I see happening is teachers being, we're constantly talking about more individualized instruction for youngsters. That's what the whole movement around class size reduction was supposed to be about. So when we talk about teachers teaching children, we're not saying teachers now don't teach other children, okay? The role of a teacher is to teach all children in that class. And our job, my job as a trustee, is to make sure that that teacher has the tools at their disposal in order to do that and not to give an excuse for not teaching other children.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to wrap up, but I thank you very much. And I use
You're
the
welcome.
Term city, inner city slang, talking using that term, which I understand is the term of the critics, and that the term of those in Oakland who support this is Ebonics.
Right.
And I thank you both very much for joining us. Again, we've been speaking with Carolee Tolbert, trustee of the Oakland Board of Education, and Professor John Rickford of Stanford University. And you're listening to Democracy Now! As we quickly shift gears into another very different subject. Gays and lesbians are coming out left and right in primetime TV these days, and for the most part, Hollywood and the news media are treating them as normal, complex, interesting people. But it wasn't that long ago that the mainstream media portrayed gays as sick, perverted, and desperate, and warned of the lavender menace that was infiltrating the government and recruiting your children. Former CNN reporter Edward Alwood went into the dark closet of American history and uncovered some of the most hateful, homophobic, and hysterical reporting that pretended to pass itself off as respectable news. Then Alwood went back and confronted some of the journalists who filed anti-gay stories, including Mike Wallace of CBS. We welcome Ed Alwood, author of Straight News, Gays, Lesbians, and the News Media, to Democracy Now! And let me ask you first what you found in your book.
Well, the point of the book is much broader than gays and lesbians, really. It has to do with the news media, how the news media operate. And one of the main topics has to do with how the media operates affects what we see and hear in the media. And so the way newsrooms operate have a big impact on what is portrayed and the images that come across in the media.
Let's talk about the history of the way gays and lesbians have been portrayed in the mass media. I was going back through the archives, the sound archives, and we hit on Mike Wallace on a program he did on CBS called The Homosexuals. Let's play a clip.
This much is certain. Male homosexuals in America number in the millions, and their number is growing. They are attracted mostly to the anonymity that a big city gives them. New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco. The permissiveness and the variety of the city draw them. The average homosexual, if there be such, is promiscuous. He is not interested in nor capable of a lasting relationship like that of a heterosexual marriage. His sex life, his love life, consists of a series of chance encounters at the clubs and bars he inhabits, and even on the streets of the city. The pickup, the one-night stand, these are characteristic of the homosexual relationship. And the homosexual prostitute has become a fixture on the downtown streets at night, on street corners, at subway exits. These young men signal their availability for pay.
Ed Alwood, can you put this in perspective?
Sure. The CBS documentary was the first network documentary ever done on this topic. And it was really a very bold move. Fred Friendly, who is heading up CBS Reports, came up with the idea. They'd done a lot of stories about controversial subjects having to do with abortion and smoking and all sorts of things. And he came up with this idea of doing one on about homosexuals. He assigned it to a producer. The producer went out and put together a rough cut and came back. And at that point, Friendly had resigned. He had had a falling out with the network and moved on and left it in the hands of other people. They took a look at the rough cut of the documentary and just hated it. I understand from the producer of that segment that he felt that it had made gays look too good. It had been too positive, is the way he portrays the reason for the network dismissing the original part of the documentary. So they reassigned it to a man named Harry Morgan, and Harry Morgan had gone to Mike Wallace and asked him to take part in the documentary, and they produced a second one, and that is the one that aired, and that's the one that your sound clip came from. I called Mike Wallace and read him that part of the script, and he listened to me read it, and there was a silence over the telephone, and I heard him say, "Yep, I said it, but that's what the psychiatrists were telling us." Now, that's a very telling commentary. And the reason it's so telling is because it tells us where this type of image really came from. It wasn't the media that was creating the image. It was the media that was acting as a conduit for this image. And one of the main points of this book is how the media, especially in the case of gays and lesbians, and especially in the case of other topics where news personnel may not have, or probably do not have, personal experience to know what a subculture is all about, they are reliant on what other people tell them. And in the case of gays and lesbians, most of the information, a huge percentage of the information, came either from psychiatrists or police. And they had their own ideology that they were trying to put across at that time. And even though the news media may have thought that they were putting across objective, balanced information, they were relying on sources that were neither objective nor balanced. Therefore, the image that was created was a distorted one.
You know, I was thinking about one of the psychiatrists that Mike Wallace interviewed, who told him, his name was Irving Bieber, "I do not believe it's possible to produce a homosexual if the father is a warm, good, supportive, constructive father to his son."
The sad part about all of that information is that Bieber had, and his heart may have been in the right place. His objectives may have been noble. But it has been proved that the methodology simply did not produce a reliable study. And much of the news that was put out during that era was based on studies by Bieber and others that were not reliable. And what I mean by not reliable is they often turned to prisons and interviewed people who had been sent to prison because of homosexual acts. Well, there are two problems there. Those are not generally the types of people who are comfortable with their sexuality. And second of all, they are also people who may not really be gay in the terms of today's definition of gay, and that is an identity that people take on. It may be that they were the types of people who engaged in a homosexual act but really weren't gay people. So the statistics were flawed, and a lot of the news media coverage, a lot of the headlines were based on this flawed information, and it really produced kind of a sad picture.
You talk about the 50s and 60s as a McCarthyite period for gays, a time when gay men and lesbians were drummed out of government service, and they sort of fell into the same category, perhaps a bit worse, though, than communists.
Yes. Well, let's back up just a bit, because the idea of homosexual had been used as an adjective, and it was used to describe an act by a person. It was not used to describe a person. Let me give you an example. You and I both can speed in our car and go over the speed limit, and we would be looked on as a person who had sped. We would not be considered speeders for the rest of our lives. In terms of homosexuals, that's exactly the way it had been. People had been able to commit homosexual acts, but they were not considered homosexual. That was that came about in World War II, when the psychiatrists in World War II tried to develop ways to weed out people who might act out on this homosexual tendency. And therefore, people were labeled as a noun as homosexuals. They became a noun suddenly. So that's where the definition really came from, was from the psychiatrists in World War II. So that is the type of definition that got absorbed and adopted by the news media, as they were relying on these types of people as sources.
And, of course, people weren't just called homosexuals. You talk about in 1954, a young reporter named Jack Nelson writing a story for the Atlanta Constitution titled 1,500 Sex Deviates Roam Streets Here.
Exactly. And if you trace back, which is the main purpose of this book, is to trace back and see where these stories came from, where this information came from. Because the media, as I say, act as conduits. They don't come up with the raw material. They take the raw material and package it in a way that explains a story and then pass it to the public. So in tracing that type of story back, what you find is that that information that Jack Nielsen relied on came from the FBI. Now, it's very similar to the case with Mike Wallace. Wallace was relying on information from psychiatrists. Jack Nielsen and others were relying on information from the police, in this case the FBI, and it was assumed that since they were a public organization that they had no ideology that they wanted to get across. Well, they certainly did, and history has certainly proved that, and especially in the case of J. Edgar Hoover.
Talk a little about J. Edgar Hoover.
Well, the information has come out that that he is certainly suspected, and there is some evidence that he himself may have been a closeted homosexual. No one is going to be able to prove that with any definitive means, but there has been research. There have been books that say this. And so it appears that this may have been a man who was very troubled with his sexuality and that it was exhibiting itself by the way that partly by the way he was handling the FBI policies on homosexuals.
Ed Allwood, author of Straight News, will be back with him in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest, Edward Allwood, author of Straight News, Gays, Lesbians, and the News Media. Ed, what about your own experience?
I don't have very much in the book, almost nothing really, about my own experiences for a couple of reasons. One, and the main reason is, the stories I found from other people so out-surpass my own experiences that they make much, much better examples. But all of us who have been gay or lesbian in the media have faced some type of discrimination or confrontation or hostility in one form or another. In my own case, I could mention two examples. One was when I was working as a TV reporter for a station here in Washington, D.C., and this would have been back in about the late 1970s. And I was holding up a document for the cameraman to shoot. And I wanted him to take a picture of it so we could use it as a background for writing that would be on the screen. The story had to do with a school budget, school board budget. So I was trying to hold it in a way that my hands wouldn't be seen, but the cover of this document could be photographed. So I was holding it by the tips of my fingers at the very edge, and we were in the middle of this hearing room, and the hearing hadn't started, but there were a lot of people around. And I hear the cameraman in a very loud voice say to me, "Don't hold it like a fag." And you just don't know how to react, and you don't really know what the person has meant. All you know is that something has happened that's offensive. Back in the late 1970s, a lot of people, including myself, would respond by just ignoring it and thinking, oh, I've been humiliated already. Why make it even worse? Today, the responses would be very different. The response would probably be a confrontation and say, what do you mean by that? Or why do you have to be so hostile? Or some way to confront it and make a point. Another example I could give you is a job interview I had in New Haven, Connecticut for a television station. I had flown up there, and I'd been there all day. I'd talked to news staff, the news director, and everything. And at the end of the day, they decided I should go to dinner with several of the staff members and the general manager of the station. And during dinner, this man told a quote-unquote fag joke. And I sat there and I thought, now, is there some message in this for me? Or is this, has he seen something? Does he know something? Is he trying to get across some subtle comment to me? Or does he just have bad manners? Whatever it was, I decided that wasn't the place for me to work, and I told them that I later that I thanked them, but that was not a job I wanted to pursue. So that's how different era and different handling of the situation come about, and I felt very comfortable with that. But we do run into those types of comments, whether they're aimed directly at us or we overhear them being aimed at other people in the newsroom.
What about activists within the gay and lesbian community? I guess you could call them media activists who started to challenge how the media was portraying them. I'm looking at pictures in your book, Straight News, which really do tell, give a history of the gay and lesbian movement. You've got a picture, for example, after the Stonewall riots of 1969 of a man holding a poster that says, Village Voice won't print gay in ads, but calls us dykes and faggots. And you talk about the protests outside the White House of the Mattachine Society and how they were rarely covered and how that changed.
Let me mention that protest out in front of the Village Voice first. That was the first protest by gays and lesbians against the news media. And it comes just a few months after the Stonewall Rebellion in 1969, which is judged as the beginning of the modern gay and lesbian movement. And the reason for that protest was twofold. One, the derogatory language that was used in the paper to describe the Stonewall Rebellion, such as the forces of faggotry, which is what they used. The second reason for this is because the paper had a double standard on their advertising policy. They would not let the Gay Liberation Front use the word gay in their ad because the newspaper considered the word obscene. But they would let people run an ad for apartment rentals and at the bottom of the ad say, no gays. So the activist in that era decided they had had enough of that. And really, that's a lot of what the book is about in terms of confrontation, and that is trying to point out a double standard used by the news media that worked to the disadvantage of gays and lesbians. And that's what a lot of these protests have been about, is trying to get the media to realize that they are not being objective and they're not being balanced, even though they think they are. They're trying to point out a blind spot. Most of the reception from the media has been to ignore them, that they don't know what they're talking about, or they are radicals, or they want the media to be biased in a different direction. And that could be. There were some of them. Much to the credit of these activists, they were not trying to tell the media what to say, but trying to tell the media that there is more to be said.
You know, I wonder if part of the blackout on gays and lesbians representing themselves is the media's overall bias against covering activists unless they do something violent. And because gays and lesbians weren't represented in the establishment, weren't out in the establishment very much in the 50s and 60s and 70s, the only way they could get their voice out was through protests and activism. And the corporate media just doesn't believe in it, doesn't cover it.
Well, you're exactly right. And for a lot of the media, I mean, I have to tell you, it's a very difficult job covering the news. I've been there, and that's part of what goes into this book, too, is my experience of having been in newsrooms. And there are many pressures that come to bear on journalists and on news organizations. And there are many people out there who want the story turned one way or turned another way. And a journalist in a news organization is put in a difficult situation of trying to figure out what is the truth. Often activists such as the ones we're talking about are ignored because journalists turn to them and say, look, I know what I'm doing. I'm basing all of this on news judgment. Well, news judgment is a very mushy type of idea. It is passed down from journalist to journalist. It is passed down from producers to reporters, from editors to reporters. And journalism tends to fall back on that to justify itself, and it's got a First Amendment that backs it up. Journalism is the only industry in this country that is specifically singled out in the U.S. Constitution as having certain rights. I wanted to mention something about Pacifica's role. The Pacifica Network had taken a lead on this topic way before any of the other media. In 1959, KPFA in Berkeley ran a two-hour interview, and that was unheard of in that day, not only in terms of gays and lesbians being willing to go on the air and identify themselves, but in terms of the media putting this information out in the public. It was a tremendous risk for a newspaper or a broadcast station to take this type of leap. And then in 1962, a similar thing happened with WBAI in New York, and they ran the very first interviews of gays and lesbians in New York. And it was at a time when the newspapers hadn't even acknowledged the existence of a gay and lesbian segment of that city. And the New York Times followed up on that broadcast by doing a front-page story about gays in late 1963. So you can see how far ahead WBAI was.
Did you know about this before you started doing research?
I had absolutely no idea.
I want to now go to talk about how the media has covered AIDS and how that is influenced by the corporate media's approach to gay men and lesbians.
The news media claim that what they put in the news is the most important information of the day. That is not always the case. Most often, it is the type of information they think the audience wants to see and hear and read. That may not be the same as the most important story of the day. So, again, the news media have to walk this certain tightrope. What happened during the AIDS crisis is many producers and editors decided that the AIDS epidemic was simply a quote-unquote gay disease and therefore affected a very small part of the population and would not be of interest to the larger segment of the population. And that's what guided the early AIDS coverage. It only began to change when Rock Hudson contracted the disease and died, and there was a public face, a public identity that was linked to the disease. But even then, often the stories had to do with children who had contracted the disease or people who were intravenous blood transfusions or intravenous drug users or that type of thing. So many of the stories still did not really get at the heart of the story, which had to do with the devastation that this disease was racking through the gay community. It has only been in recent years that we've begun to see this type of coverage. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that news people began to know people who had contracted the disease, whether it was a family member or a neighbor or someone in the newsroom. And I point out several examples of journalists who had contracted the disease that had a huge impact on their own news organization and how that organization viewed the disease, and then went on to have a huge impact on the entire news industry.
Talk about a few of them.
Well, Jeffrey Smaltz had contracted the disease and didn't even know that he had AIDS, and one day working at his terminal at the New York Times in the newsroom, fell out on the floor and went into a grand mal seizure in the middle of the newsroom. The health reporter, Larry Altman, came up, and who is a doctor, and began to administer to him, as they call the ambulance, and took him to the hospital. It was only then that Jeffrey knew that he had AIDS and had to have brain surgery. As a matter of fact, it was very, very serious. And he did return to work. And at that point, the New York Times had to confront AIDS in a way they never had before, because AIDS was now in the upper echelon of the management of the New York Times. And it wasn't just this faceless, nameless type of disease that was going on around the country. It was a disease that had struck someone that was very highly regarded, a very talented person, and they had to respond to it in terms of an individual rather than an abstract.
And what did they do?
The coverage began to change. As Abe Rosenthal moved out of the, I'll call it driver's seat, certainly the top editor's slot in 1986, and Max Frankel moved in, who had a much different view of the world and a much different understanding of what society was like, they began to change their coverage, and in 1986, 1987, they ran their very first AIDS story on the front page of the paper, having to do with how it was ravaging the gay community in New York.
Weren't there questions around whether Jeffrey Smaltz could cover gay issues or AIDS issues in an objective way?
Yes, but that's a question that's plagued gay journalists forever. Whether they can cover any story having to do with gays and lesbians.
I mean, it's an interesting question, considering people don't ask whether a reporter can cover a white issue or a woman can cover a woman's issue.
Well, and I didn't see anybody during the Defense of Marriage Act ask if married people should be covering that.
And let's talk about a few other people, like Linda Villarosa, the executive editor at Essence, who announced her lesbianism in a 1991 article, and Randy Schultz of the San Francisco Chronicle.
One thing I wanted to point out in the book is that there have been concerns among media owners that if they had open gays and lesbians on their staffs and allowed them to cover news, write about news, whether it be gay and lesbian news or just general news, that somehow or other the readers would fold up their newspaper or switch off their radio or television set and go running out of the room and never again pick up that newspaper or that broadcast. That is simply not the case. And what I wanted to do is point out situations where there were some gay and lesbian journalists in very high positions. And Linda certainly is, as executive editor of Essence. Andrew Sullivan at New Republic is another who is in a very high place. And then, as you mentioned, Randy Schultz, who was really the first open gay reporter on a mainstream major daily newspaper. And people didn't fold up their magazines and newspapers and go running out of the room. This is a red herring. Gay and lesbian journalists are just as talented, just as equipped to run a publication as anyone else.
As you finish this book, and now it's out there, you have spent a long time in the bowels of the Library of Congress and going crisscrossing around the country interviewing people, looking at archives. Do you feel that we've come a long way?
Oh, we've come such a long way. It is absolutely incredible. I was not only impressed with that, but what I was most impressed with was how the progress has been based on a lot of people who have made incremental progress wherever they were. And the progress they have made is in terms of trying to portray the truth as the truth exists. And relegating gays and lesbians to invisibility is simply not the truth. And reporting on AIDS as merely a gay disease simply is not the truth. And so there have been a lot of people who have been painstaking in trying to do what little they could, and each has done a very little bit that has added up to a very large shift in how gays and lesbians are seen in the news media.
Ed Elwood, your view of outing, the media outing someone.
Outing was a tool. Outing was, I want to go back to something I said very early in this interview, and that is activists pointing out the double standard that has existed in newsrooms. Outing was a tool that some of the activists used during the AIDS crisis to point out that the media was using a double standard. And what has happened is by relegating either gay people to invisibility or the gay part of people's lives into invisibility. And what I'm thinking of is people who for instance, would attend public functions with their a man with his boyfriend or a woman with her girlfriend, and the media take pictures of them hanging around with someone of the opposite sex rather than the person they had really gone to that event with. Or, for instance, in the case of Malcolm Forbes, Forbes being a very closeted man, but it was well known in many circles that he was gay. But all of the pictures showed him with Elizabeth Taylor and other women at his estate. And the media was taking part in this willingly by putting across this type of image. The idea may have been to, whatever, protect his privacy or not offend the readers or not offend him or whatever. But the truth of the matter is it was putting out the type of image that was not the truth. And so in outing, outing is sometimes misdefined. Outing is where a gay and lesbian person, gay or lesbian person, reveals the sexuality of another a closeted gay or lesbian person. It's not where just the media comes up and announces that someone is gay. That's often seen as outing, too. But the real outing is where activists have decided that the double standard of protecting a person's identity is just not worth it anymore when there is this type of hypocritical part of their lives.
Ed Elwood, I want to thank you very much for joining us, the author of Straight News, Gays, Lesbians, and the News Media. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin, Dan Coughlin, and Errol Maitland. Our engineer, Errol Maitland, thanks to Kevin Cartwright. Tomorrow, a Christmas Day special on Democracy Now!, we talk to Christian activists, among them Reverend Dr. James Forbes of the Riverside Church and Jim Wallace, author of or founding editor of Sojourners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
59 minutes, 15 seconds. Universal time, 14 hours, 59 minutes, 20 seconds. U.S. Naval Observatory Master Clock. At the tone.